In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
Welcome. Thank you for joining us today here on the iSpy Radio Show. We are keeping an eye on big government. Today's show deals with a fundamental aspect of government, borders and boundaries. For most people, boundaries are things on a map. If you're on the left side of the political aisle, I suppose you think borders are antiquated beliefs and they ought to be erased. But boundaries define countries. They are also the cornerstone of civilization and peace. Everything on this side of the river is ours, and over there is yours. We don't take your stuff, and you don't take ours. But it's more than that, because over here we are a republic, with rights of free speech and religion, with rights to own land and private property. While over there, you guys choose to let someone who was born to a certain family decide everything for you, and basically everything belongs to your government, instead of you. Defining borders also creates economic wealth. Anything that is valuable becomes more valuable when it is hard to obtain, and countries will defend their advantage in natural resources. But things change. For thousands of years, petroleum would seep out of the ground in various forms and was mainly used as a sealant and waterproofing. Moses' mother used tar and pitch to seal his basket. Noah's Ark was sealed inside and out with the stuff. For most of mankind's history, when you dug a well, you were disappointed when you hit oil and not water. But along comes the Industrial Revolution, and suddenly all of that changes. That useless oil on the other side of that border is now incredibly valuable. On today's show, we're talking about geopolitics and how a better understanding of it can lead to a better understanding of the conflicts around the world and why they develop the way that they do. For example, why is China defending North Korea? And could they actually want the conflict between North and South to continue? This and lots more on today's show. You know him as a frequent guest on iSpy Radio for his insights into the climate change hoax, but during his time at the University of Winnipeg, Dr. Tim Ball also taught classes on geopolitics. For some time now, we've been wanting to have him on for a show about geopolitics, and with North Korea rumbling like a volcano about to blow, we thought now is the time. Dr. Tim, welcome back. Thanks for joining us today.
Well, thanks for the opportunity, and I got to start with a brief little story that tells you something about the dynamics of the world of the last 40, 50 years. I wanted to call the course geopolitics. The university wouldn't let me because we're starting back in the 70s and early 80s, but the word geopolitics was, of course, coined by the Germans, and it was used with regard to Hitler's approach to things, that is that you have to put together the history and the geography to understand the dynamics of what's going on. And so the university wouldn't let me call it geopolitics. So they finally let me call it political geography. And I went with that because I thought that the information was far more important than any argument about a title. That is part of what's wrong with today's world, is that, and I could give you an example of a Canadian prime minister who said Canada's problem is too much geography and not enough history. The truth is we got lots of both, but Canadians know very little about either one. Yeah. And unless you can put the geography and the history together, and the way I like to describe it is geography is the stage and history is the play that's played out on that stage. You can study them independently, but you really don't get a grasp of it until you do that. And so that's the background of how I got into this.
So that would be your definition then of geopolitics, is that geography is the stage and politics is the play that's enacted upon it?
Yep, and history in the context of politics is how you deal with working on that stage. Tell you what triggered me to teach the course. It was 1967 with the Egypt-Israeli war, and I was listening to a report, and they said, Israel had taken control of the Gita and Mitla passes in the Negev Desert. And I'm saying, I know those names. Where do I know those names from? And then it dawned on me, they're in the Bible. they're mentioned in the Bible of if you want to control that part of the world, you have to control those passes. And here we are 2,000 years later, the geography is still dictating the same thing.
Wow, how cool. You know, here on iSpy, we like to say that the best information does you no good if you can't use it. So what's the usefulness of the field of geopolitics? I mean, how does it help a person better understand what's happening in the world?
Well, it helps you understand where the conflicts are, where the potential hotspots are, and how to deal with them going forward. Because one of the problems without this wider understanding, all that we live in is a world that is just crisis management. That's going on, and the media, of course, hyping it up and putting pressure on the people that have to make political decisions. But we're really into crisis management, and there's no need for it. You can identify the potential trouble spots of the world very easily, and you can do it just by looking at the history books, you know, where the wars occurred. But just to give you one example that we need to talk about today, virtually every boundary in the world is relatively new. For example, there are only four boundaries in Europe that are over 100 years old. But most people don't know that. They think, Italy's been there forever. Italy was formed in the same year that Canada was, 1867. And the number of boundaries that have changed in Europe, even since the Second World War, is something like 19 boundaries or countries have disappeared and 23 new ones have appeared. But everybody thinks that all of this is very static and has been around for a long time. And the other problem is that the boundaries don't coincide with the cultural pattern of peoples, nation states, for example. They're, most of them are what we call superimposed boundaries. That is, during the colonial era, they simply drew a line of latitude or longitude or a straight line on a map. And as Winston Churchill said, no conflict is ever resolved until the land is settled on. And we can talk about that in the context of North Korea, because that boundary was simply an agreement that doesn't fit anything. It doesn't fit the geography. It doesn't fit the cultural. It's going to have to change. And the forces will keep pushing it to that change. But you can look around the world. Look at the African boundaries superimposed. Look at the American state boundaries. A lot of them don't make any sense whatsoever. Now, you kind of learn to live with them because, you know, you're peaceable people and you prefer to work things out democratically. But look at it on a smaller scale. The constant adjustment of municipalities and voting districts and the gerrymandering that goes on as they try to, get more people under the Democratic or Republican Party. So the boundaries of the world are a very, very good clue to going forward and to where the potential hotspots will be.
Yes, absolutely. Okay, that's a good place to take a break. Coming back, we'll be talking some more about geopolitics, especially in the Korean Peninsula. Stay with us. And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. We're talking about geopolitics today, and we're doing that with Dr. Tim Ball. You know him for his work on exposing the fraud of climate change, but he also taught classes up at the University of Winnipeg on geopolitics. And just to kind of sum up a little bit from that first segment there, basically put, geopolitics is the study of boundaries and the resources within those boundaries. Is that a good way to put it?
Yes, it's the idea of, and we can go through the whole evolution of that, because, of course, one of the things that has evolved historically that America was founded on was the private ownership of land. Mm-hmm. And that is a concept that didn't occur until America. Mm. Prior to that, the state owned everything. But even prior to that, you identified people by their leader. For example, you say Attila the Hun. Right, and it's not till you get to the Elizabethan era that you get into Elizabeth of England, and so you start to associate the people with an area, a geography, and a boundary. So all of these things have occurred in the last 500 years, and of course they're still being sorted out and where the conflicts come, and usually what triggers the conflicts is over resources and access to those resources, and that's part of what's underlying what's going on in the South China Seas right now.
Well, that's actually where I was heading with that. So what are the geopolitics of the Korean area? Because North Korea fired off an intercontinental missile this week, which is, you know, really the reason why we wanted to have you on here, just because now all of a sudden North Korea is the focus once again. And that is such a huge quagmire. So what are some of the geopolitical issues there?
Well, the geopolitical issue is, of course, that they never resolved the conflict out of the Cold War because they're talking. It's interesting that Trump is in Poland now and talking about NATO, but NATO was one of five treaty organizations, and they were set up to contain the communism around the edge of Europe and Asia. So you went from NATO in the north and west, and then you had the Middle East Treaty Organization, the Central Treaty Organization, and the Southeast Asia Treaty Organization, of which South Korea or Korea and Australia were part. That collapsed with the spread of China pushing out to control its boundaries, as it is, as always done, by the way. That's why they built the Great Wall of China, was to prevent invasion and to control the people around the edges of their country. And so that when America looked, was in South Korea, the Chinese were pushing, and they finally came to a sort of a dead end, because China was simply not that powerful at that time, but they settled on the 38th parallel, and you see there's a line of latitude that's imposed upon the landscape. It cuts the Korean people completely in half. But the other thing that's been going on in that whole area, you look at the Vietnam War, for example, well, this was part of the containment of communism under Foster Dulles and all these treaty organizations. And it was interesting also, of course, was access to the resources. It started with Japan's invasion of Manchuria in the Second World War because they needed the resources in Manchuria. But at the end of the Vietnam War, and again, a boundary between North and South Vietnam, and that gradually disappeared. But what people didn't pay much attention to was that the minute that Vietnam got its independence, it went and sat on a group of islands called the Spratly Islands. And if you go and look at the map of the Spratly Islands, they lie off the coast of Malaysia. But within a week, the Chinese showed up with gunships and blasted them right off the island. And the reason for that is, of course, that's sitting in the middle of huge oil reserves, massive oil reserves in the South China Sea. If you look at, for example, one of the richest people in the world, the King of Brunei, that's on the edge of that massive oil deposits. And so whenever you look at these battles and conflicts, it's almost inevitably that the underlying two things that underlie it. One is people want their nationality and a place, a state, so that the nation wants a state, but then they also want to control the resources. So virtually all of the battles and wars that have gone on throughout time have been about that, and they're still going on. I mean, just think. I'll just throw a little idea into you here. You know, we've been talking about the Middle East. I used the term already in the program. Well, middle of where? East of what? why do we use that term?
That's a good question.
We're talking now, right?
No, I said that's a good question.
Yeah. Well, and it's like we're talking now about the South China Seas. Well, people refer to that as the Far East. Well, it's of course these are colonial terms. This was the British Empire. And it was Middle East as far as London was concerned, and it was the Far East and Hong Kong now. Look at the battles going over Hong Kong, where President Xi just showed up in Hong Kong and said, stop, you're causing trouble. Stop trying to get democracy and freedom in Hong Kong. Mm. Well, what was Hong Kong? It was a coaling station for the British Navy. Mm. And so we're seeing all of the conflicts and all of the battles and all of the ongoing trouble spots are all a function of the history of the area. And unless you put all of that into context, you're not going to make any sense about what's going on in the world.
No, that's for sure. In fact, let's talk a little bit more about that in the next segment. So coming up, we'll talk about more about the quagmire that's happening there in North Korea. Stay with us. Dr. Tim Ball is a retired professor from the University of Winnipeg. He is a frequent guest of iSpy Radio. You know him for his work exposing the fraud of climate change, but he has also taught classes in geopolitics. And today we're focusing on geopolitics, especially North Korea, and I'm sure later on we'll be talking about Trump's second international trip. So we were talking about North Korea here, and there's just something that I have found to be interesting, which is, you know, you've got this situation where China just seems to take North Korea under its wings to protect them. And no matter what kind of stupidity comes out of there, China just seems to stand by them. What is China protecting in their relationship with North Korea? I mean, why is North Korea so important to China that they seem to be going out of their way to protect them?
Well, this has always been China's approach to everything, is to control, as I said earlier on the program, to control those areas around it. I mentioned the Great Wall of China because of the invasion of the Mongol hordes from the east. And China, of course, calls itself the Middle Kingdom because it sees itself as the center of the world and the center of the universe. And its role is to defend its borders. The one thing that China fears about an invasion of North Korea is 28 million North Koreans fleeing across the border into southern China, and they simply don't want to accept that. Now, if you look at what China's done in Tibet, I mean, the brutal suppression of people, so they'll either do that directly or indirectly, as they've done in North Korea. So and Hong Kong, I mentioned earlier, if you just look at all of the territory around China, that has been their practice. The difficulty they've got with North Korea is not so much that if they're attacked, they will invade or move into China, but there's also the problem that if the two Koreas get together, And North Korea, and don't forget, there are a lot of people, a lot of relatives on both sides of the border. They have the common heritage and common history, and it could become a very powerful nation with the nuclear weapons and with the power of the economy of South Korea. So if and it's just part of a traditional way of empires controlling. The British did it best.
That brings up a question then.
Yeah.
Are we not seeing peace between North and South Korea because of the other entities out there, between China and Russia and the U.S.? And are they trying to keep these countries apart?
Well, I think that China is definitely trying to keep them apart. And you see quite often overtures between the two Koreas to try and have talks. Even Kim Jong-un has done it. And because of the... say that they are a nation of a common language and common heritage and common history, and the boundary, as I said, was superimposed as a false boundary separating them. Now, if you look at that throughout history, I mean, look at what Hitler did. What excuse did he use to invade the Sudetenland and into Czechoslovakia and Poland? He said, "Oh, the areas I'm invading are German-speaking people with German history and nationality. I'm just making them part of Germany." Huh. And so, of course, China doesn't want that. It doesn't need a very, very powerful Korea right on its border.
So I can understand then, from China's standpoint, is the reason they keep propping up North Korea is because they don't want the two Koreas to unite.
Right.
But, I mean, are there resources there in North Korea that China has its eyes on?
No. The only they're doing it is they... especially because of the sanctions that were imposed on North Korea by the Americans and by the UN, but North Korea has a lot of coal, And China's been buying a great deal of coal from them, and that's been maintaining their economy. But of course, that's the difficulty, that you can become a slave to your resources. I mean, look at what Trump said in Poland today, where he said, look, Russia's has controlled you by turning on and shutting off the natural gas pipelines.
That's right.
And a lot of people don't realize the extent to which Europe is totally dependent on Russia for natural gas. Ukraine, they did it in the Ukraine. They just suddenly tripled the price of gas and said, either you behave or we'll push it up even further. And Trump said today, we will not let the Polish people be dependent upon a foreign resource or have a foreign country jerk you around for resources. Well, that's exactly what the Chinese are doing with the North Koreans.
So in terms of China, we understand why they would be supporting North Korea. Why is the U.S. involved in that part of the world? I mean, are there resources there that would benefit us, or is it more along the lines of this is a long-term effect of the World War II treaties and also the Korean War, that we're defending our allies, in other words?
Yeah, it stems from that, and in fact, it goes back to actually a 1904 when this started. A guy by the name of Mackinder, Sir Halfred Mackinder, was sitting in his office in Oxford University, and he's looking at a map of the world. And he said, if I wanted to control the world, which area of the world would I want to occupy? And he noticed that a very, very large green area, which indicates grasslands and lowlands, no mountains, is the 500 miles around Moscow. And he called that the World Island. And he said, if you controlled that, you could control the world. And of course, we know that's what both Napoleon and Hitler had as their target. That was their ambition, to get there. And of course, it was also the Vikings before them, because a lot of people don't realize the Vikings went east. In fact, Moscow was set up by the Romanovs, who were the descendants of the Normans, which were the Vikings invading there. But what that World Island idea, Mackinder's World Island, was, that became then the focus, and it shifted the world away from the power of nations and the power of the oceans, which, of course, the British controlled, and it shifted the world back to controlling land. And the result of that was, as I said, it led through to the development of communism, the containment of communism with those treaty organizations. And now what we're dealing with is the fallout and the vestiges of all of that, the bits and pieces of it. But everybody's dealing with it without any real understanding of what's going on. I mean, when Putin says that NATO was set up to suppress and contain Russia and prevent our expansion, he was absolutely right.
Yeah. Well, and they needed to be contained. All right, let's go ahead and take a break there. Yeah. Coming back, I want to talk to you about the oceans and the controls of them. Stay with us. And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. I'm your host, Mark Anderson, talking today to Dr. Tim Ball, and we're talking about the field of geopolitics and especially focusing on North Korea. And, you know, going into that break there, we're starting to talk about some of the oceans and whatnot. And of course, it really changed from where it was 100 years ago, where shipping was such a huge important matter. And as you said, Britain really ruled the seas. Why don't you talk to us a little bit about the boundaries on the seas?
Well, the idea of boundaries on the sea comes in at about the same time that you're starting to get nations being formed. I mentioned earlier about how you start to identify people with the region that they occupy instead of the leader. And in England, that came about with the was brought to a head with the Tudors, with Henry VIII and Elizabeth, and you start to form nation states around the world. You draw boundaries on the land, of course, where normally the best boundaries are the ones that coincide with physical features, such as rivers or lakes or mountains. One of the perfect boundaries is the Pyrenees between France and Spain, and so it's over 100 years old. But then you've got the problem of how far out into the ocean do you extend your land boundary? And that became a problem as nations could attack other nations from the oceans. And so they decided to draw up a Law of the Sea. Grotius wrote a book called Law of the Sea in the 16th century. It's still basically the one that everybody uses. The Hudson Bay Company had a copy in their files. And you extended the boundary out to the distance you could defend. So what became the extent offshore that your boundary was drawn was how far you could fire a cannon. And that was, in those days, about 3 miles. So that became the extension. But then you've also got the problem of, if you've got a boundary between two countries, how do you extend that off the shore? Now, none of this has ever been really ratified or agreed upon. It's just like with using a cannon, it's been done by your ability to defend your region. And by the way, one of the things that as nobody even talks about is how high up does your country go? Because now you've got satellites and spy planes going over, and the U-2 with Gary Powers, it got shot down over Russia. Well, that kind of set the limit of how high Russia or Soviet Union was. But there's been many attempts to draw boundaries on the oceans, and none of them have really come to anything. It's really been determined by the British with the power of their navy, and then of course more recently with the American Navy. And one of the things that you see going on that Trump did was he moved two task forces, naval task forces, off the Korean coast. And these are very powerful flotillas of basically cruise missiles with nuclear warheads sitting off your coast. And you noticed the other day that America also sent a destroyer very close to those islands that China is claiming in the South China Yes. Seas. So this whole issue about the oceans, and of course then there's the issue of international waters. Who controls them? What happens to the resources under them? None of this has ever really been agreed upon at all. And so these are conflicts that we're going to see going forward.
Well, and of course, with the resources, that's really one of the real drivers there of the conflicts that's happening in the eastern China Sea there. Because you've got these oil reserves around these disputed islands where both Japan and China are claiming them, and they're completely uninhabited. They've got goats on them, I guess. But other than that, there's no inhabitants to speak of. But there's massive oil and natural gas reserves there. And so when you're talking about the boundaries of a country, and then by extension the boundaries out into the oceans, I mean, that's where these things really come into play.
Exactly. And especially if you've got a continental shelf, that is the shallow water immediately off your coastal line. Canada, for example, and in the Arctic, the Arctic shelf is huge, continental shelf, and that's where so many of the resources are. But if you look at, for example, the Arctic Ocean, there's been no agreement on who owns the Arctic Ocean or how it's divided up. Currently, it's divided up in what they call the sector theory. That is, they simply took, say, the boundary between Canada and Alaska and extended that to the North Pole. Well, if you do that, you see that Russia, in fact, controls over almost three-quarters of the Arctic Ocean. And there, of course, the resources up there that they're claiming. The same, you've got a problem in Antarctica. And Antarctica is divided up in the sector theory, like pieces of pie. But the problem there is so much of Antarctica is controlled by the colonial powers that occupied it at the time. Southern Hemisphere countries are saying, hey, we should have control of that.
Yeah.
But that's not the reality. The good news about Antarctica is the UN did agree that there would be very limited resource development because of the potential environmental damage. But all of those things have got to be resolved. And by the way, Antarctica has got some of the best and most extensive coal reserves in the world. And so you're going to see growing conflicts over these and aggravated by the very crude boundary system that we've got. And people are just going to have to sort these things out. Otherwise, you're just going to continue to have wars.
Yeah. I don't think I knew that about Antarctica. That's fascinating. I think let's go ahead and take a break early here because we've got some loaded questions here still for you. Everyone stay with us. We'll have lots more with Dr. Tim Ball talking about geopolitics. And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show, talking today to Dr. Tim Ball, talking about geopolitics and just fascinating discussion in terms of boundaries and the resources within them, and how so many of the conflicts between countries comes down to a control over resources. And we were having a great conversation off mic there. You were saying how there was this massive oil reserves up there in Canada, and yet the cost to extract that is so high that as Trump is pushing more barrels of oil out into the market, it is lowering the cost, making it harder and harder to get those reserves. It's just a fascinating discussion of the balance of powers and also the balance of resources, the uses of those resources. We talked earlier about Russia and how they were essentially blackmailing so much of Europe because they control so much of the resources, the energy resources. I mean, there are so many different aspects to this field of geopolitics.
Yep. Well, it is, because, and of course, one of the reasons that it isn't very popular, and but except to the public and your listening audience and so on, is because it requires a generalist overview.
Yeah.
And one of the problems that we've got into is specialization, and it's just like we've talked about with the climate and environment issues. Everybody's got a piece of the puzzle, but we've lost the box top. So when you start to put even just the basic pieces together, as we're doing with geography and history and politics and resources, suddenly the picture starts to appear. Now, I mean, you're only doing it in terms of finding the corner pieces of the puzzle or the edge pieces, and you're piling up the pieces in different colors, but at least you're starting to understand what the whole picture might look like. And until you do that, you really can't understand, and I don't think that you can establish policy. But one of the things that also is helping with the over-specialization is that the world is finding out that these people are coming out of universities, and they only know something about one small thing. So the political and the business world is going back to the universities and force them into creating interdisciplinary studies. And you see that in environmental studies, the problem is with that the people become jacks of all trades and masters of none.
Yeah.
And they really still don't understand the picture. But this is what we need to have more of. And by the way, just to give you an illustration of how this can work, the Mayo Clinic is so successful. Because what they do is, when you go there as a patient, you're just put through a battery of tests. Then all of the specialists sit around the table with the patient and look at the overall picture and even talk to each other, right, and come up with the solution.
Yeah, I can tell you from personal experience, the whole talking to each other in the medical field right now, that just simply doesn't happen, unfortunately. In terms of geopolitics,
yep.
In terms, especially with North Korea, they fired off what has, for the first time, has been classified as an intercontinental ballistic missile. This has the U.S. notably worried, because now they can reach points in Alaska. And, you know, again, talking about resources, there goes a missile, destroys your oil fields up there. So in terms of a response to North Korea's aggression, and the U.S. has said that they are putting all options on the table here, first of all, should we respond? I mean, doesn't any country have a right to self-defense? Because if they believe that the U.S. is an aggressor to them, don't they have a right to develop defensive capabilities?
Well, they do, and every country has a right to defend itself. And of course, one of the charges has been, well, how can America have nuclear weapons and North Korea is not allowed to have them? And that was part of the Obama idea. But what it requires is, of course, that the country demonstrates the maturity and not to use those weapons. Now, in the Cold War, it reached an impasse because they got to the point of mad, as they called it, was nuclear. but assured destruction. In other words, if you start the war, we'll fire back and we'll just obliterate each other, and there's no point in doing that. But what the world has to do, and this is again what Trump's speech in Poland talked about, was you've got to live in the world, and yes, you can be your own individual country. But if you are doing things that threaten other countries, it's like the problem you saw socially in the United States in the 60s and 70s. People say, well, I'm going to do my own thing. But it was always at somebody else's expense. And at what point do the other people say, no, what you're doing, it is also impinging on my freedoms and rights. And, of course, that's the argument that's being paid with North Korea. They are a rogue state. They are not agreeing to play by the general rules of the civilized world.
Yeah, I don't think anybody is necessarily going to trust North Korea with a nuclear weapon. Other options on the table are economic sanctions, the military options, diplomatic options, political options. There's a lot of other things that we could be doing. If you were advising President Trump, what would you be suggesting that we do?
Well, I would recommend that he does exactly what he's doing. And if again, when you read the tweets, what he did was he said, okay, China, I'm going to give you the chance to rein in North Korea. And he made that announcement after he met with President Xi in America. And, of course, then you saw a tweet just recently, or about a week or so ago, where he said, nice try, China, but you failed. And what he's doing is putting them on notice that if they're not willing to rein in North Korea because it's in their neighborhood and in their back door, then America's going to have to do something.
Yeah. Well, that may involve sanctions against China because 90% of North Korea's trade comes from China. All right, everyone, stay with us. We're going to wrap things up there with Dr. Tim Ball talking about the geopolitics. And coming up, we'll be talking about Trump's trip to Europe. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're in our final segment now with Dr. Tim Ball. He has also taught classes up at the University of Winnipeg on geopolitics, which is the focus of today's show. And so I'd like to shift gears from North Korea to Trump's second international trip. He's there in Europe right now. And this is in the middle of all of this geopolitical arm wrestling. I mean, he's there in the belly of the beast, so to speak, because he's going to be meeting with the G20 on Friday and Saturday. And then he's going to be meeting with Russia and all that. So far, anyway, from that speech in Poland, he's had a very successful trip already, and he's just getting started.
Yes, I think that his speech in Poland today, in the square in Poland, was one of the most significant speeches by really any American president on the international stage. Hmm. There have been Lincoln's Gettysburg Address within the nation and so on, but in terms of the role of America as a hyperpower, and I think that's what people have to understand, relative to the rest of the world, the comparisons between American military power, American economic power, most people have no idea just how vastly different it is on the scales. Mm-hmm. And what Trump, with that speech, getting ready for the G20, was putting the world on notice about, first of all, America's back. It's not going to police the world. It's not going to bully the world. But it is going to fight for the things that America stands for, which is freedom in every sense of freedom for the individual. And of course, I think that that's he also, of course, included within his speech why that is so essential with North Korea. I mean, nowhere in the world is the plight of the individual more suppressed than in North Korea.
Yeah.
And so I think that he will. And look at the task forces that he's moved in. Now, I was in the military during the Cuban crisis, and I know what an American attack force comprises with the aircraft carriers and the five and the cruise missile destroyers and the submarines that accompany them, and the firepower that is now in the Japan Sea and the South China Sea around Korea is just phenomenal. And of course, he's also directed McMaster and Mattis to come up with a strategy. Now, he's not going to announce any of this. I think what you'll see is that a complete takeout of all of the critical missile launch sites of North Korea before they even get a chance to attack Seoul. But in that speech in Poland, it was literally a world speech that put the world on notice about what America's about, what it's planning to do. And I can tell you with the reception, and he chose Poland deliberately, because nobody's been a greater supporter of freedom and been more suppressed and bullied by communism and Nazism and fascism, as Trump said in his speech, than Poland. So the location, the content of the speech, the message was just absolutely phenomenal. And one of the things America's got to realize is that there's an awful lot of us outside of the United States that have been praying and pleading for America to fulfill its role and its destiny of bringing freedom to the rest of the world.
Well, I agree with you that Poland is a great place to have him give that speech. I mean, and especially in terms of geopolitics. I mean, it is an area of the world that has been fought over and fought over. The borders have been constantly shifting. Russia would take control of it, and then Germany and back and forth. And so it really is fascinating that he chose Poland to give that particular speech.
Well, you look at Poland and Czechoslovakia, that whole corridor through the North German plain. And, of course, that's why Berlin is so important, because it effectively controls that North German plain. And throughout history, you've had these armies of people marching back and forth. And I always said that, Poland and Czechoslovakia simply open the door at one end, let the army in, and let them out at the other end. And of course, this is why they are so grateful for Trump coming in and saying, look, we're going to stop that. We're going to, and he actually repaired the damage that Obama did, because Obama went in and Poles were told, look, if you go along with us, we'll defend you. And then Obama canceled the missile defense system. Trump, he didn't take the missile system with him, but he told them it's on the way.
Yeah.
And of course, that's huge.
Now, is that the land-based missile system, or is that the ship-based missile system?
I believe it's the land-based missile system.
It is the land-based. Okay.
Yes. And of course, as I said, what Trump is doing is putting a very large American foot down across the middle of Europe, which has been the focal point of wars, and just that's where you've got to start. And by the way, Mackinder's World Island saw that. I mean, the lines they drew in Europe, like the Maginot Line and so on, these were lines to try and control these armies moving back and forth through Europe. And Trump has simply, without knowing it, has built another wall across Europe to stop these armies migrating.
Well, I think one of the key aspects of his speech was that he is saying that without actions, the words are pretty much meaningless. And I agree with him on that one. I think that's so true for any aspect of life, but certainly when it comes to matters of geopolitics. And like you said, he's not only talking about freedom, but now he's given the Poles this missile system to defend themselves.
Well, of course, it's also the theme of his Art of the Deal, because he said that there's no point if you're not willing to pull out or say I'm ready to walk, if you're not ready to be reasonable, then there's no point even trying to strike a deal. And of course, that's what he's saying here. He's saying this is what America's going to do, and if you think we won't back it up, you're deadly wrong. And of course, he did that with Syria. Look at the reaction when the cruise missiles went into Syria. It's just absolutely amazing how the world reacted to that.
Yeah.
Now, there were a few that were angry, But and I this is one of the arguments that I've made with regard to, you know, Canadians saying to me, "Oh, America's this does this wrong and that wrong," and I kept saying, "Look, you better be grateful that America's the hyperpower, because you sure as heck don't want any of those other nations in the world doing it."
That's for sure. Yeah, imagine if Putin and Russia were the strongest nation in the world. Unfortunately, we are up against the clock with you, yeah. Dr. Tim. I want to thank you so much for your time today. This has been a fascinating discussion.
Oh, thank you. There's so much more we can talk about.
Yes, for sure. You know, it would be nice to live in a world where nations competed to make better products, not better weapons. But of course, it's never that simple. Just like it's not just about natural resources within a country, but about the politics of that country. Europe has had thousands of years of kingdoms all fighting with one another. They're used to being told what to do. America is the exception to history, and I'll take America's freedoms and liberties any day. And maybe someday Europe will wake up to the fact that it's not diversity that makes you stronger, it's unity. That's all our time. Help us out if you can. Visit our advertisers on iSpyRadio.com and share our website with your friends and family on social media or word of mouth, because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.